This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, Yellowstone Park Superintendent Finley updates us on the status of buffalo and wolves in the park as winter sets in. The woodlands that stretch across New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine are known as the Great Northern Forest. Efforts are underway to protect it. We meet the leaders of Predator Project, a group in Montana that protects critters that eat other critters. And in the Earth Calendar, endangered kit foxes are mating in the San Joaquin Valley in California. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Yellowstone National Park, America's best-known and probably best-loved park, has been in the news as a result of court orders stemming from lawsuits about how the park is managed. While the order has been stayed, one judge has required that the wolves, successfully introduced last year, be removed. Another judge has ordered steps be taken to prevent the wholesale killing of buffalo that took place last winter, when the beasts moved out of the park seeking winter food. They were killed as they crossed into Montana because the state is afraid buffalo will jeopardize the brucellosis-free designation of Montana's cattle herd. Some buffalo are affected with a disease which causes cows to abort. The man on the front lines is Mike Finley, superintendent of the park, who joins us from his office at park headquarters. Mike, we've heard a lot about buffalo. What is the status of the herd right now? How are they doing?
Well, the herd's doing very well. So far, we've had such a light snowfall year, I assume due to El Nino, that for the most part, they've stayed in the park. There's plenty of forage available. When we had the large mass movement last year, it wasn't because there wasn't enough forage available. It's because in December, we had lots of rain that then froze and formed a layer of ice that they couldn't get to. So they sought lower elevations, and as they left the park, they were shot or processed by us as a threat to Montana's brucellosis status.
Now, as a result of the ruckus last year, my understanding is that you do have a different management plan that was drafted as a result of last year's situation. What does that call for?
Due to the huge mortality of over 1,000 bison last year, we modified that plan in such a way as to cut down the mortality as much as possible. For example, we had the Animal Plant Health and Inspection Service, APHIS, agree that certain animals were low risk and could be outside of the park in the winter on national forest land, those animals being bison, bulls, calves, and yearlings that have no real threat of passing brucellosis.
My understanding is that you've also had some lawsuits that relate to not only the bison, but the wolves as well. With respect to the bison, what are the courts telling you about how you need to manage that herd?
Well, one of our jurists in Helena, Montana, who's maintained jurisdiction when the state of Montana sued us over their brucellosis-free status and bison management, I think is greatly concerned about the mortality last year. Has issued an order from the bench that no more than 100 bison are to be killed this year. He has directed me to prepare a feeding plan, an emergency feeding plan for, quote, severe winter conditions, and to recommend those segments of road in the park, which are groomed during this time of year for snowmobile and snow coach travel, that may be temporarily or partially closed to prevent the movement of bison outside the park.
And just briefly on feeding, from a biological standpoint, does it make any sense to feed wild animals as though they were in a feedlot?
No. Behaviorally, it's the wrong thing to do because most of these ungulates have herd memory. They're like dairy cattle. They remember where they get food. Two, when you concentrate wildlife, as any state fish and game authority will tell you, you enhance the possible transmission of disease from one species to another, and not just brucellosis, but tuberculosis, parasites, any number of things. So while I understand the motive of the judge to look at ways to mitigate bison migrations and so forth. Feeding is something that even the state of Montana has outlawed.
Okay, now let's talk about your wolf population. How are they doing?
They're doing great. In terms of the program's ahead of schedule, it's under budget. We've had some difficulties with the predation by certain members of the reintroduced wolves on sheep outside the park, but by and large, the majority have behaved themselves. They're functioning ecologically, taking elk like they should, and you know, we welcome them back. They're part of Yellowstone. They should have never been removed, and now they're back, and we want them to stay.
And they're taking coyotes as well, as I understand. Is that going to change the ecology in ways that may be interesting or different?
It'll be different. In fact, all the carnivore biologists predicted that when you reintroduce the wolf, that your coyote population will drop, and coincidentally, not coincidentally, but directly, your fox population will rebound. And it's interesting because the coyotes were the top canine-type predator here, and they would kill foxes with prejudice. Wouldn't eat them, just kill them as competition. Now that the wolves were reintroduced, they see the foxes as no big competition, but directly kill coyotes with prejudice. And so just what we predicted, or what, not what we predicted, what the carnivore biologist predicted is taking place. The coyote population is being depressed, and the fox population is rebounding.
That was Superintendent of Yellowstone National Park, Mike Finley, who manages one of America's premier ecosystems and the thousands of visitors who come in summer and winter to visit it. As environmentalists in California attempt to save the headwaters forests from development, another hotspot is surfacing on the other side of the country. Among the unfinished pieces of business left by the 105th Congress when it adjourned for the year was legislation that could preserve the largest piece of contiguous forest east of the Mississippi. The northern forest covers 26 million acres, stretching from the tip of Maine through New Hampshire, Vermont, and New York. Supporters of the bill say it would preserve both nature and a way of life, while opponents believe it would lead to another federal land grab. Correspondent Mitch Tyke has more.
This parcel of land not far from St. Regis Falls in northern New York State is a study of quiet on a late fall afternoon. Aside from the occasional finch, nuthatch, or squirrel doing some final winter preparations, the light breeze is the only thing that stirs the bare branches of the thousands of trees in the area. But it's this area that's home to several endangered breeds, animal species such as the spruce grouse, and a way of life called logging. They're endangered because the land is up for sale, land Michael D'Annunzio believes should be set aside.
This is the type of area that we hope to preserve our natural heritage in an undiminished state. That is, we hope that our children and grandchildren will be able to come to areas such as the Champion Lands in the northwestern Adirondacks to see what the park and its low-elevation boreal biomes were like in this century, in the last century, and in the millennia since the Ice Age.
D'Annunzio is the Research and Education Director for the Adirondack Council, an environmental organization based in Elizabethtown, New York. He's been concerned about the fate of the so-called Champion Lands. This fall, the Champion Paper Company announced that it's putting its entire land holdings in the northern forest up for sale. That includes more than 150,000 acres in the Adirondacks alone, much of which D'Annunzio says is significant both in the context of the Adirondacks and on a worldwide level.
We're dealing with watershed lands that purify the waters, that act as habitat for many rare and endangered species and threatened plants and animals, which occur, if anywhere else outside the park, in much lesser numbers and in habitats that are modified by man.
So far, no buyers have emerged for the more than 300,000 acres of land Champion is selling in the northern forest. Environmentalists are pressing the governments of both New York State and Vermont to purchase significant portions, but that may still be a long way off. And that has many concerned about who could emerge as a buyer in the meantime. Andrea Kalnes is the director of the Montpelier-based Northern Forest Alliance, which in March of this year called for the state to protect 95,000 acres of Champion's land in New York.
There's been continuing big-scale land transfer in the Northern Forest. The council had found something like 20% of land base had changed hands in the 10 years of time that they looked at, and that trend's continued since the council closed up shop. So that instability is there, and the dynamic that those sales create, even though they're still being bought by timberland owners, is that they are, each time they're sold, they're encumbered with debt, which has sharp impacts on the profitability of those lands and their ability to manage them.
The council that looked into the issue of land ownership was the Northern Forest Lands Council, which came into being after another timber company, Diamond International, sold off 1 million acres of land in 1988. The council included 4 people from each state in the Northern Forest: a landowner, a state government official, a local government official, and an environmental representative. In 1993, the council produced its final recommendations, which formed the basis for the Northern Forest Stewardship Act. It's a bill that proponents say balances the rights of property owners and environmentalists. It would allow governments to buy vulnerable parts of the forest, but those parts would have to be identified at the local level and would be restricted to willing sellers. It would also provide federal dollars to strengthen and diversify the economies of communities within the Northern Forest. The act failed when it was first introduced in 1994, but supporters reintroduced it in the current congressional session. It's co-sponsored by Senators Judd Gregg, a New Hampshire Republican, and Patrick Leahy, a Vermont Democrat. Leahy says the bill seeks to calm the fears of people on both sides of the debate.
Well, I think the act makes a great deal of sense, and that's what people like about it. It's not a Washington solution. It's not something dictated by Washington, but rather something that all solutions come from the local level. The way the Northern Forest Act is set up, it presupposes that the people who live in the area will determine what's the best way of using their forests and gives them the tools to do that.
Leahy says the bill works on several levels. It provides funding to protect lands each state identifies, supports research on forest ecosystems, and also supports the continued private ownership of forest land. Leahy and other supporters of the act say without the legislation, they fear large parcels of land will be bought by speculators who are more interested in squeezing money out of the forest than in preserving the status quo. But opponents say that wouldn't happen. On its first try through Congress last session, the bill passed in the Senate but died in the House. Concern groups such as the Blue Line Council, which represents private landowners in the Adirondack Park, say the bill doesn't go far enough to help landowners make a living in the forest. John Broad is a spokesman for the Blue Line Council.
The act blatantly ignores, I think, one of the central recommendations made by the Northern Forest Lands Council to reform state and federal tax policies in order to, I think the words they used were, reinforce the traditional patterns of land ownership and uses in the Northern Forest.
Brott says without additional help for landowners, a door is open for governments to purchase large amounts of the forest. Supporters of the Northern Forest Stewardship Act say government action is still needed. They say their bill intentionally leaves tax matters mainly in the hands of local governments. A related bill would reduce estate taxes for landowners committed to stewardship. And supporters say while federal money would be made available to preserve forest lands, choosing what lands to buy would be made at the local level. But with both forest bills still being held up in the Senate, observers wonder whether the test case will be the Champion land sale or the next big sale to come along. For the Environment Show, I'm Mitch Tyke reporting.
You're listening to the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Elton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. The Environment Show would like to hear from you. Our phone number is 1-888-888-888. 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. green@wamc.org. You're listening to The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley, and our Ear to the Ground is next.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, saving a place for America's predators. For the folks at the Predator Project, protecting the wild animals that eat meat means getting beyond the old notion that the only good predator is a dead predator. Advocacy work such as protecting wild habitat goes hand in hand with promoting new attitudes about predators and their ecological role in the minds and hearts of the American public. Since 1991, Predator Project founder and director Tom Skeel has been fighting to protect 12 predator species.
Our most well-known are the wolf and the grizzly bear, but also the black bear, the mountain lion, the coyote, the lynx, or the wolverine, the fisher, and the marten. All of those are forest predators. Some of those obviously can also be grassland predators, but all of them are definitely forest predators. Out in the grasslands, we're looking at the black-footed ferret, the swift fox, the burrowing owl, the ferruginous hawk.
Located in Bozeman, Montana, Skeel says their work focuses primarily on forest predators in the northern Rockies and grassland meat-eaters in the northern plains region of Montana, Wyoming, North, and South Dakota. Most people, Skeel says, think of predators as animals that hunt down living animals for food, which they do. But what they don't understand, he adds, is these animals depend a fair amount on scavenging as well. Another misconception in the minds of most people, Skeel says, is that predators keep prey in check, while actually the opposite is true.
It is the numbers of snowshoe hare that keeps the lynx in check, and not vice versa. It is not the number of lynx that keeps the snowshoe hare in check. So as the snowshoe hare population goes through its 11-year cycle from a really high level, population level, to a crash, you will find the lynx populations following basically that same cycle, and their population numbers, you know, relevant to the snowshoe hare numbers.
Skeel says predators are essential to help keep the balance of the natural ecosystem and points out you can't have wildlife without wild places. Habitat loss is a big problem for wildlife, and a big cause of habitat destruction is roads. That's why, Skeel says, they developed their Roads Scholar Project. That's R-O-A-D-S.
It's, yes, a clever little play on words, and no, we don't go to England and drink beer while going to college. We actually go out into our national forests here in the Northern Rockies in Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho, and do surveys, on-the-ground inventories, of the number of roads that are on our public lands, not only the roads themselves, but also the effectiveness of road closures.
The motivation behind this, he explains, is due to a large body of research indicating roads have huge effects on wildlife, from the obvious impact of roadkill to the dissecting of land into parcels, creating habitat that is not secure or intact. Roads jeopardize water quality, Skeel says, through siltation, when dirt runoff from roads affects streams and rivers. And roads can cause a change in animal behavior. The group also works to reform the Federal Wildlife Services Program, formerly known as Animal Damage Control. Skeel says this agency, which works primarily in the interest of ranchers, spends $35 million a year to kill over 100,000 predators. Pushing for protection of predators is ongoing work for Predator Project, and so is protecting their prey.
So in the grasslands region where we're working, we're not only interested in the black-footed ferret, the swift fox, the burrowing owl, the fuliginous hawk, but all of those animals are either entirely dependent on or largely associated with the prairie dog and the unique ecosystem that the prairie dog makes. So here's a case where, in fact, we're actually advocating for a prey base because of the benefit that it has to predators and to the natural ecosystem at large.
Tom Skeel says for him, working to protect predators is what makes his socks go up and down. He's optimistic about public attitude towards predators, citing the reaction to wolves in Yellowstone as a good example. He hopes through the work of Predator Project, consideration, appreciation, and enthusiasm for the wild carnivores will grow along with their populations. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. It's mating season for California's San Joaquin kit fox. They begin pairing up in mid to late December and early January. The pups are born in February or March and usually remain underground for another month or so. The kit fox has been on the endangered species list since the early 1970s, so the mating season is a critical time, according to Ron Schlorp, a wildlife biologist with the California Department of Fish and Game.
Based on our studies, there are indications where there are pairs that, you know, pair bonds that last for more than a couple of years. These animals living in the wild don't really last very long in the wild. They have a maximum of 3 to 5 years in the wild. The oldest ones we've had are about 8, and they may have several different mates during that period of time, you know, each year as they pair up because of the survivorship of adults and young being limited, or the mortality rate is pretty extreme.
Urban sprawl and agricultural development of native areas combined with chemical pollutants have kept kit foxes on the endangered species list. So many kit foxes are lucky if they make it for another year, let alone to find an eligible mate. But if a mate is found, the couple will build a home to accommodate the growing family.
The habitat of this animal is open plains kind of a habitat. In California, it's what we call desert scrub. It's grassland and shrubs are throughout its habitat. And within that, there are often several dens. The dens are used primarily for escape cover, so that the animal can escape from its predators, and also to spend the day, the daylight hours, underground, because it is active primarily in the evening, throughout the evening and early morning during the night hours. It's a nocturnal species primarily. But during the breeding season, a particular den is chosen to be the pupping den, the den where the young animals are kept during the early part of their development.
The den may be moved a couple of times during that period to keep predators like the coyote off track. In July, young foxes leave the den. They are very fast runners, which enables them to feed on kangaroo rats and jackrabbits. Ron Schlorf says that while the kit fox is a member of the dog family, it looks more like a small cat.
It looks like a, if you can imagine, a typical fox, except that it's rather small in size. It's only about 5 pounds as an adult. In weight, when you see a kit fox, you're first struck by the fact that it looks kind of skinny, kind of emaciated looking. That is part of its adaptation. It's a very lean animal. It's adapted for an arid environment. It has relatively large ears, which are used as radiators to remove excess heat, and also as excellent auditory detection antenna, if you will, so that it can hear the movements of its intended prey and also the movements of its predators. The coyote is the primary predator of adult kit and young kit foxes in the San Joaquin Valley. The coloration ranges from a sandy brown. There may be a little bit of reddish color around the legs and in the shoulder region, but generally speaking, it's kind of a grayish tan color.
Schwarf says their coats get more luxurious during the winter months, which protects them from the cold desert nights. He says kit foxes are also found near San Francisco, but like other areas in California, development continues to reduce habitat for this endangered animal. Fortunately, as a result of the Endangered Species Act, you won't see kit fox furs on winter coats. But when it comes to the breeding season, biology, not legislation, is the key. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, author Steve Lerner describes people he calls eco-pioneers. They're not environmentalists, but he says they're finding practical ways to fit in with nature. We talk green about environmental engineering and the Monsanto Corporation. Are they splicing genes to grow crops sustainably, or will they increase our dependence on weed killers that they manufacture? Our listeners comment on environmental racism, nuclear power, and green Republicans. Stay with us. For two decades, journalist Steve Lerner has followed and documented environmental problems. But now, he's shifting his focus away from eco-dread, as he calls it, to people he believes are making a difference. Lerner is author of the new book titled Eco-Pioneers, Practical and Visionaries Solving Today's Environmental Problems. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott recently spoke with Lerner about the book.
Let's talk a little bit about the term eco-pioneer. What is an eco-pioneer? Is it an environmentalist? Or are they the same? Do you use them interchangeably?
Not at all. There are a number of eco-pioneers in this book who are not poster material for the environmental movement. I'll just give you one example, a man named Jack Turnell in Wyoming, who is a rancher. And Jack Turnell runs a ranch which is a little smaller maybe than the state of Rhode Island, called the Pitchfork Ranch, a giant thing, and his cattle graze on public lands as well as private lands. And there are many environmentalists who don't think that's a good idea. Yet he has figured out a way to reduce the negative impact of his herd on the land. And actually, Jack, hosts photo shoots from the Marlboro men, you know, they're in their chaps on their Mustangs and their cigarette and so on. Environmentalists would just go haywire if they saw this. But he's a man who has figured out how to keep his cattle from overgrazing in fragile riparian ecosystems, basically along the streams there. And that reduces their environmental impact. And instead of herding them all at once up, you know, one area of a mountain, he splits the herd up and sends them up different watersheds. And in that fashion, reduces the erosion they cause and so on.
When you set out to write the book, did you have certain criteria in terms of who would be in, who wouldn't be in, what you were looking for, and what actually, or who actually is an eco-pioneer?
No, I didn't. I developed a loose definition. I'm not an academic type. And I didn't have a set methodology that's going to pass academic muster. I'm a journalist. And what I do is, after 20, 25 years writing about environmental issues, I had a lot of sources all over the country and, in fact, around the world. And I spoke with many of them, and I said, look, I've heard the problem. Who's coming up with the solution? And so I was kind of set on the trail of looking for people doing cutting-edge work in coming up with these practical solutions, and one would lead to another. I'd find a guy in Chicago, Scott Bernstein, who is solving problems of inner-city neighborhood in Chicago, figuring out how to retrofit buildings so they're more energy efficient, figuring out ways of taking blue-collar jobs like electroplating and making them more environmentally safe, helping the people who run these businesses find access to capital in order to be able to run their factories in a more environmentally safe way.
Your book focuses on many people who benefit financially from and help the environment at the same time, kind of business-oriented environmentalism. Is that sort of a message in it or not?
Well, I hope so. Actually, not all of them are benefiting financially from it. A number of them are, you know, I guess what could loosely be called eco-entrepreneurs. And I hope there is a message there that you can do well financially while doing good for the environment. A lot of these people are figuring out new ways to meet many of our needs that fits in better with nature.
How do you see the environmental movement today, and is that something that's addressed in your book?
Well, in a sense it is, because I spent 20 years of my life writing about kind of the downside of our technology, all of the eco-disasters that we read about in the paper every day. But what this book represents is a change for me, and I think also to, in a certain degree, a change in the environmental movement in general. And that is not just focusing on what's wrong, but saying not only should we not do it this way, but this is the way we should do it. I'm now in the business of looking for environmental solutions, practical solutions. I mean, the American people are an ingenious people, and we have a well-deserved reputation for that. And what we have to do is begin to focus that genius on figuring out how we can fit in better with nature and how we can meet our needs in a way that fits in with nature. So if there is any message about the environmental movement, it is that we are beginning to turn our attention, not giving up on telling people what we're doing wrong in this country and in terms of the environment, but adding another note. And that other note is there are people out there who are coming up with really good solutions to our environmental problems. We should honor them. We should shine a light on them. And we should figure out a way to move their work into the mainstream.
That was author Steve Lerner talking about his new book, Eco Pioneers, Practical and Visionaries Solving Today's Environmental Problems, published by MIT Press. We're talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're talking about genetically engineered crops. And this involves the putting of genes in plants such as corn or soybean or cotton, so they take on special characteristics like the resistance to disease or insects or even the ability to survive certain weed killers or herbicides. And the leading developer of this transgenic crop process, if you like, is the Monsanto Corporation. And Monsanto is also the producer of a weed killer, which is widely used and known as Roundup. And in recent years, Monsanto scientists have been able to develop strains of corn and soybean and cotton that survive the weed killer Roundup. The significance of this is that the farmer can put Roundup on his field and plant the genetically engineered crop so that the weeds are killed and the crop survives. And the commercial gain, of course, is that with a patent on the seed, The producer, in this case Monsanto, can lock up a market for both the seed and the pesticide. And there are some who question whether altering crops to encourage the use of an herbicide is a good idea. We want to know what you think. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. I have two guests with me today, Dr. Randy Deaton, and he's an engineer from the Monsanto Corporation, and he joins us from St. Louis. Also with me is Paul Clark, and he's a genetic engineering campaigner from the environmental group Greenpeace, and he joins us from New York City. So, in order to get this going, Dr. Deaton, can you tell us, before we get into too much about herbicides and so on, what is it, how do you genetically engineer a crop plant? How is that done?
Well, Peter, there's a number of ways in which it's done, but quite simply, it's just identifying a piece of DNA, genetic material, that confers a certain characteristic. And through various processes, we introduce it into the crop plant that we want that characteristic to be expressed.
And once that's done, then the crop produces seed which can be planted. Am I right about that?
Correct. The plant then carries that characteristic, and it's transferred just like it is with all the other characteristics it has through its genetic material.
Okay. So given that circumstance, I guess the question that we'll be focusing on is whether genetic engineering of crops is a better way to feed a hungry world, or is it just a way to sell more herbicide or Roundup? Where do you come out on that one?
Well, of course, we're in the business of providing products to farmers and to consumers of farm products. So we're interested in making money, but we're also very interested in the environment and providing products that people want. And we think biotechnology is a very valuable tool to help us do that.
Now, Paul Clark from Greenpeace, I understand you have some real reservations about not only what Monsanto is doing, but this whole process.
Yes, that's correct.
What are they?
Well, we have some serious problems with the implications and the repercussions that these genetically engineered crops will have once they are introduced into the ecosystem.
And for folk who haven't thought about that, what does that mean?
Well, basically that means by introducing this entirely new living organism into the ecosystem, there are various repercussions that could occur, whether it has an impact on a changed use in pesticides or if it has an impact on the sharing of that genetic code with other wild and related plants.
So your concern is that once this plant that has been created as a result of science as opposed to through some other process, that it then gets loose in the environment with bad consequences. Is that your major concern?
Basically, these are, in a way, alien species that are being introduced into our ecosystems. It is unable and it's impossible to predict what the outcome is going to be over the years of these plants continuing to be planted and continuing to grow.
Dr. Deaton, is this a problem?
Well, these crops are engineered for very specific characteristics. We currently face in our agricultural production system the use of chemicals to produce the food and fiber we need for this world. Without those products, we would be facing much more ground would have to be plowed under and put into production to feed the world. And we think that the use of biotechnology and the traits that we can provide in terms of insect resistance or certain kinds of weed control products provides better options for growers than they have today for doing that.
Well, let's look a little further into the biological side of this. It is charged by the critics of Monsanto that while genetic engineering may be a useful way to reduce the use of pesticides and so on because you could produce plants that are resistant, what really is happening here is a matter under which what Monsanto is trying to do is just capture and lock in the market so that the weed killer Roundup and the seed are sold together and the world winds up awash in Roundup, but that we really haven't moved forward as we should in reducing the dependence on chemical weed killers and pesticides. What do you say to those folk?
Well, last time I checked, growers are able to choose whatever product they want to use that's approved by the EPA on their farms for production that they need to make to make a return on their investment. And so they have choices of using a number of different products. We just offer this choice to them as well. And if they find the benefits to be suitable, then they use it. And we're finding that growers are finding these technologies to be quite valuable.
And before one had the Roundup-resistant plant, how was the plant and the herbicide coordinated in the past so the herbicide didn't kill the plant?
Well, companies like Monsanto would typically try to develop herbicides that didn't harm the crop plants, so you could use them without harming the crop. And basically, you had natural resistance already there. All we're doing in this case is just introducing that resistance when it didn't already occur previously.
And Paul Clark, do you see evidence of difficulties that genetic engineering have led us to date?
Yes, we do see that several of the genetically engineered crops introduced onto the market have so far shown uncertain performance. The New York Times has recently covered problems with Monsanto's Roundup Ready cotton in Mississippi. Also last year, there were problems with Monsanto's Bollgard cotton in Texas and various other states. So that we see that, you know, while it may sound great in principle, that by introducing these genetically engineered crops, we'll be offering farmers a much better package. In reality, we don't really know what's happening when we're introducing these into our farms and what is the repercussions are going to be for farmers.
When you say problems that have developed with respect to cotton and other things, what kind of problems are you referring to?
Well, for example, this year, planters of Roundup Ready cotton in the South had several problems where when they sprayed it with Roundup, the bolls would fall off the plant. Monsanto is currently facing legal action by farmers in Mississippi due to this problem with the cotton. This is similar to what happened last year with Monsanto's Bollgard cotton, where the plant, which is supposed to produce its own pesticide within the plant, did not produce enough. Therefore, cotton fields were subject to insect infestation, and a huge crop loss was experienced.
But it sounds to me that you're describing a situation in which the genetic engineering has not performed in the way that the developer or the seller in this case says it will, but you're not describing an environmental problem other than the fact that, of course, the farmer loses his crop. Is that what the concern is, that this stuff isn't doing what it's advertised to do?
Well, this is the most immediate response that we've seen from the genetically engineered crops. Many of the environmental problems will take several years to really develop. However, we did see that with last year's Monsanto cotton problems, the cotton which was supposed to produce its own insecticide within the plant, this could rapidly lead to insect resistance to that toxin, which would basically mean farmers would have to use increasing and heavier doses of pesticides. This is an environmental issue when the insect resistance develops.
Well, Dr. Deaton, how do you deal with this issue in which insect resistance has been common, I guess, with respect to ordinary chemical pesticides? And will the genetically engineered crop also produce bugs that are resistant and create more problems that way?
Well, just to go back a little bit, we've been very happy with the performance of our products, and we've been had some concerns that have been raised in the marketplace, but we're addressing those and are very happy with the way things are going. Certainly, we think there are a lot of environmental benefits that we're trying to derive through the use of these products. For example, with the use of our Bollgard cotton, which is engineered to resist insects, we estimate to reduce pesticide use about 250,000 gallons of insecticide in cotton last year. We're certainly concerned with those kind of benefits of trying to make sure the product has as long a life as possible, and resistance management is something that we've taken very seriously and has been a very integral part of how we've introduced this product and marketed it.
Paul Clark from Greenpeace, do you see that the genetically engineered plant, whether it be cotton or something else, is a way to reduce the use of pesticides, which are now currently being used extensively, particularly in a crop like cotton?
Well, whereas there may be a short-term reduction in the amount of pesticide use, as this insect resistance develops, this means that farmers will basically have no other choice but to use increasing amounts of pesticides. So while there may be a short-term gain, it's a long-term loss.
But isn't that resistance something that occurs whether the pesticide is either in the form of the genetically engineered crop or comes out of the nozzle of the sprayer? I mean, isn't that a process that goes on no matter how the pesticide is introduced?
Well, insect resistance to any type of pest treatment is a serious problem. One of the particular problems with the genetically engineered cotton is that the toxin being used in the plant is derived from a common biopesticide that is used in organic farming and sustainable agriculture. This biopesticide has been used by farmers for years without a development of insect resistance. Now, with the planting of the BT cotton of Monsanto's Bollgard, basically insects are being exposed to this toxin and will rapidly develop a resistance. This will eliminate one of the most safe and widespread biopesticides available to farmers.
Is this a problem, Dr. Deaton, that by using a pesticide that now is currently used that we'll lose the effectiveness of it?
I think you said it earlier, Peter. I mean, you cannot use technologies without running some risk associated with those kinds of things occurring. And to reap the benefits of the BT, then you have to use the product. Currently, right now, it's only used on less than 0.5% of the entire market, insecticide market in this country. And we would like, through biotechnology, to see it used on many more acres so that those benefits can be realized.
Let me ask you both something. Obviously, when one talks about genetic engineering of plants you can conjure up all sorts of things in your imagination. I remember a law review article once that was entitled "The Kohlrabi That Ate Pittsburgh." It was the plant that ate the place. And so as a result, we have various screening requirements to make sure that this stuff is safe and well thought out before it's put out on the market. How good is the process that the EPA and others now use to sort this stuff out? Paul Clark, how does that look from your perspective?
Well, I would say that many of the regulatory agencies have been rather lax in granting their approval to the introduction of these genetically modified crops. With the example of the plant pesticide crops, whether it's the BT cotton or BT corn and potatoes, even people inside the Environmental Protection Agency have admitted that they have not adequately taken into account all of the various information on insect resistance before granting the approval for these crops.
Also, your concern is that we're just not tough enough in terms of looking this stuff over before it hits the market.
Exactly. Our administration's position is basically very pro genetic engineering and pro getting these crops onto the world market as quickly as possible.
Okay, our time is limited. Dr. Deaton, how do you folks at Monsanto see it as you run your new products through this regulatory process?
Well, from everything we can tell, there's never been any products that have probably been more scrutinized than these have in the ag sector, and both within the regulatory agencies and an open dialogue with those that are concerned about these technologies. And we've done everything we can to make sure that they've been tested and thoroughly evaluated and openly evaluated.
And how is this testing done? You come up with the magic plant that has all kinds of characteristics. What happens before you can get that on the market?
Well, there are certain tests that are required of us to conduct relative to the regulatory agencies that oversee this, and then that's all made publicly available for anyone to evaluate and to make their case, and if there's more testing needs to be done or any concerns.
And if you had to ever pull a product off the market because it's found to do things that you had not anticipated?
Has Monsanto ever been asked to do that?
Yes.
I really can't speak to that. I'm not aware of all the details of our business, whether that's ever been required, but not to my knowledge.
Okay, I'm afraid our time is up, and we've just gotten to the beginning of this subject. We've been discussing genetic engineering of crops, and specifically Monsanto's development of crops that can be planted with their product Roundup, which is an herbicide. We want to hear your views about this. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And my guests have been Dr. Brandy Deaton from the Monsanto Corporation and Paul Clark from Greenpeace. Again, we've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can hear The Environment Show anytime over the Internet. Our address is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. We've had a lot of action on our comment line. Rachel Phillips lets us know what you are saying.
Thanks, Peter. Listeners called in on a number of different topics. Our first caller says a recent discussion on environmental racism lacked important elements.
We're listening to the information about environmental justice, and there was actually not an answer addressed to a very crucial question, which is, What's the factual basis for this differentiation among different incomes and whether it does, in fact, correlate to race and all of that? The woman from the EPA did not really address that. She gave more of a political statement, and it would have been really nice to have heard some factual information about the basis for this. So please, hopefully that'll happen in the future. Thanks.
Our next listener heard the recent discussion on nuclear energy and whether it's a good method for reducing carbon emissions.
I've just been listening to the Environment Show in a discussion about nuclear energy, and I was astonished to hear the discussant say that we would bury the nuclear waste in canisters deep in concrete and under the earth. But no one discussed the ramifications of this in future years. Clearly, we are mortgaging our children and grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren and seven generations and God knows how much longer to gratify our lust for energy.
Finally, a recent Talking Green, looking at the Coalition of Republican Environmental Advocates, a newly formed group to help promote environmental issues within the Republican Party, inspired this listener to call in.
I can't even believe that the Republicans are talking about themselves as environmentalists in any fashion. I mean, I can see how some individuals might, but in general, the Republican Party stands for big business and, you know, business as usual. It's quite amazing to me to think that they might try to even portray themselves as environmentalists. I think it's a positive thing. I mean, it's not a bad thing that they are starting to think this way. Thank you very much.
We appreciate all the feedback we receive, and we hope that you will call. Also, in a future Talking Green, we'll be discussing the issue of wolf reintroduction. If you'd like to be a part of that discussion, give us a call with your name and a daytime phone number. You can reach us at 1-888-49-GREEN. Again, that's 1-888-49-GREEN. For The Environment Show, I'm Rachel Phillips.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Don't try to splice any genes, particularly not your own, without a copy of the show. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 417. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer. Producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Westcott. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for The Environment Show.